This is a work session of the Labor Social and Leadership Affairs Committee meeting on Friday, March 6th. This is the Committee on Labor Social and Business Affairs meeting on Friday, March 4th, 8 o'clock in the room B.
Senator Wyatt, who agreed to be with us this morning to make a call. Senator Roberts, the fifth year to members in Washington, D.C. Meeting has come to order.
Good morning.
Corporal Melfers is present and is taking a roll call. We're going to change the order a little bit because of the request of people that will have some traveling to do. We'll pick up SB-19 first.
Somebody out there that's on the leadership, they seem to need it.
Frank Howard, I think it would be appropriate if you testify on the amendment that has been offered.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Frank Howard, representing the Insurance Commissioner. Senate Bill 19, as it was originally introduced, changes the list of exemptions under the insurance code. People that can be exempted from most of the provisions of the code but have to comply with certain things to get a certificate of exemption. And we raised an objection at the hearing initially to this change in those exemptions. We thought it broadened it on BOA, and we suggested that the particular problem that this bill was addressing could be met by making a change in the requirements for a licensed organization under ORS Chapter 750. The ambulance service that originally requested this legislation is a licensed healthcare contractor under ORS Chapter 750. And they have told me that their principal problem is the surety bond requirement under that chapter, which costs them quite a little money every year. And we agreed with them that that surety bond probably was of minimal necessity, and that we would draft an amendment that would eliminate that surety bond requirement under certain conditions. And that's what this amendment does. It says that a licensed healthcare contractor that has at least 75% of its assets invested in the facilities it is actually using to provide the health care may shall not have to have this surety bond that otherwise is required. Most of our healthcare contractors would not be affected by that because most of them are in the nature of financial organizations, not directly providing the healthcare themselves. Kaiser Foundation Health Plan is about the only one I can think of offhand, other than the Eagle Point Ambulance Service, that would probably meet this exemption. And the $50,000 surety bond is just seems like it's probably superfluous. If an organization is already geared up with its assets invested in the facilities, it's probably going to be able to maintain its ability to provide those health care services. And so we submitted this as a solution to the problem that caused this bill to be introduced in the first place.
What would this do to a rural fire department in the ambulance service?
The only time the insurance code comes into play at all is where prepaid subscriptions are being solicited for providing ambulance service. And under the general definition of insurance, this constitutes an insurance arrangement. And ORS Chapter 750 specifically applies to organizations that provide prepaid ambulance service. so far we have not had very much of that kind of activity in the state of Oregon. Any ambulance service that does try to develop a prepaid subscription service would be subject to ORS Chapter 750. But under this bill, they could come in and, as long as they had $25,000 of net worth, they could be licensed. I don't know where the typical rural fire department would fit in that. I think if there is a problem, Sandy, I think this ambulance service thing is probably a relatively new and expanding field, and there may be some attention needed to the provisions of Chapter 750 that call for licensing of all ambulance services that operate on a prepaid basis. So I think at the moment, for the Eagle Point Ambulance Service, this bill does what they're anxious to have done.
Well, I have had quite a bit of correspondence over from the volunteer ambulance services and their insurance rates, but this bill doesn't affect that at all. Huh?
No.
It
doesn't come at all.
Are there any questions from the committee?
Mr. Coos. Mr. Howard, if bill passes, it's my understanding Eagle Point Ambulance paid a bond recently. Would they get a refund on that?
It would just depend on whatever arrangements they could make with their insurer. Mr. Miles of the ambulance service indicated to me that their insurer was willing to write the bond on a down payment of some kind, and that the balance of the year's premium would not be required if this bill becomes effective and they don't have to have the bond in effect for the whole year.
But they can receive some financial help on that.
Yes, this would be, I understand, of immediate financial help. And for that reason, I should have mentioned that they have asked if an emergency clause could be put on this bill in order to save them the full premium for this year's surety bond. And we're certainly in agreement if the committee is willing to attach an emergency clause to the bill.
Thank you. Any other questions? What's the pleasure of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I would make a motion to move the adoption of amendments and also insertion of the emergency clause.
Senator Howard moves the adoption of amendments and the insertion of the emergency clause. Any discussion? Any opposition?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
I'm all ears.
This is going to apply to the Kaiser Health Plan as well as the Eagle Point.
It's my understanding it would. Is that true?
Right.
Yes, it would apply to any healthcare contractor that had the bulk of its assets in its actual healthcare facility. Its impact on a large organization is minuscule because the bond requires, I don't think the larger organizations have a bond anyway. They file their actual assets with us, like a savings account or certificate of deposit, that kind of thing. Save them the expense of the bond premium.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
What these the Eagle Point Eagle Point ambulance service is not a volunteer ambulance service,
is
that right?
That's right.
No, it is.
It is.
It is a volunteer.
Opposition to the amendment? If not, amendment shall pass. That's the pleasure on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I move the bill out with DPAS recommendation.
Can you hear me? Senate Bill 19 is for the DPAS recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Hannan?
Aye.
Senator Johnson?
Aye.
Senator Wyatt?
Aye.
Would you like to call?
Senator Hannan for the bill. Okay, let's go to 301. I believe it's a new amendment to that bill.
No, that's not the bill. I think we need to get an offer to the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, the markup bill reflects the amendments adopted by the committee March 2, and I've also passed out an alternative draft of amendments, which does not change the substance of the amendment, but creates a new subsection and divides the language a little bit, which may be more clear.
Mr. Chairman, I move we delete the amendments of March 2nd and substitute the amendments dated March 3.
Senator Carson moves that we delete the previous amendments and substitute the amendments dated March 3. There any discussion? There any opposition? Hearing none, so ordered.
I move the floor be passed as amended.
Senator Carson moves 301 to the floor with be passed recommendation. Mr. Carroll.
Mr. Chairman, let me just explain for my understanding is that the major concern was the thrust of the bill is to obviously to block the indemnification aspects of it. But in certain industries, primarily in the utility area, it's very common for the utilities to enter indemnity agreement or contribution agreement. So we wanted to protect that practice. And the amendments go to, I believe, and I'm telling Mr. Wyman does and others have helped us on it, to make it clear that the bill thrust continues to apply generally, but as to individuals or corporations that are associations subject to 757 or 760, they may continue to enter agreements or warranties that are contrary to the trust of the bill. And then we change the effective date from tried to filed. And I think this shows what the committee was talking about this afternoon.
Any further discussion? Next, clerk, call the roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Hannan?
Aye.
Senator Johnson?
Aye.
Senator Wyatt?
Aye.
Senator Carson, would you say that?
Yes.
302.
Which will you explain this?
This bill was heard once before the committee. This is the bill that would attempt to set definite statutory time frames for the Workman's Compensation Board to notify injured workmen of benefits, and also setting time frames within which the Workman's Compensation Board service coordinators would need to contact and work with an injured workman and refer that worker to either physical rehabilitation programs or vocational rehabilitation. At our last testimony, Bob Kennedy of the AFL suggested that 2 days would be appropriate on line six, and Pat Gill of SAIS felt that 90 days would be appropriate on line 10. Of course, those are only suggestions.
Are there any other suggestions from members of the committee? Is there anyone in the audience that wants to make a comment or a recommendation? Mr. Kalinowski? Mr. Chairman, when we testified on this bill, we pointed out the existence of a House bill that had been introduced at our request that, just to add a little further confusion, has 30 and 37 days in it. I might ask if the committee's had a chance to review that bill. We suggested that it might be advantageous to merge the two bills for the same purpose, or for the same purpose.
Well, that's quite different than this. What's the rationale now?
Does this bill, both bills, refer to a time period, do they not, Mr. Chairman, to contact the injured worker following the injury?
Yes. In the first case, it actually is 30 days instead of a 2. And then 37 days in the second instead of the 90.
Right. My purpose in sitting here now, Mr. Chairman, is to ask if your staff had an opportunity to see if these two couldn't be put together.
Well, I think they can. As I read the House bill, this is basically a early warning type bill where there's going to be some kind of review made of the worker's injury and some kind of determination made early whether this is the type of injury that's going to lead to either a permanent total or partial, a permanent partial type disability. It doesn't speak directly to a set time period in which that worker would need to be contacted by service coordinators with a view towards actually getting them involved in a rehabilitation program.
That's the major thrust of the bill, Mr. Wyman, of the House bill. I know both the AFL-CIO and the AGC, and I'm sure other interested groups are very concerned about getting to the injured worker as quickly as possible so that he may get under either a physical or a vocational rehabilitation program as early as possible. The House bill sets, at least what I think is a reasonable time period, 30 days, and goes on to say that the Workman's Compensation Board will do it if the private carrier or SAFE does not do it. And then they'll collect their costs.
As I understand the House bill, it will also create a new situation where for the first time the Workman's Compensation Board would have the authority to reduce an award of benefits if the workman did not participate in a recommended type of rehabilitation program. Is that
Oh.
It's been a while since I read my own bill.
Well, on page 20, line 24, notwithstanding any other provision, if the board finds that the workman has refused to accept medical rehabilitation treatment as provided, the board may reduce any benefits awarded by the workman by such amount as the board considers appropriate. I think that's quite a deviation from what we have. It's approaching the same kind of administrative clout that we see in the British Columbia.
Right.
I apologize, Smith, for not having this bill. It'll be here in a moment, the copy of the House bill.
I didn't mean to delay action on the bill, Mr. Chairman. I simply wanted to ask if consideration had been given.
What's the status of this bill in the House?
It's in the House Labor Committee. It is not yet scheduled for hearing, as committee may know. There's, I think, 8,000 workman's compensation bills introduced.
It just seems that way, Jim.
It just seems that way, yes. Well, it'd be my recommendation, if it's all right with the committee, that we do not take any further action on 301 this morning. We ask the staff to check with the staff of the House Labor Committee. I'm sorry, 302, and we'll proceed on with our schedule. Is that all right with the rest of the committee? Make sense? Yeah.
Chairman, we're going to run into this problem. We've got a number of bills I've never seen so many identical bills introduced to this session, and somebody's going to have to make a move.
Yeah, good idea. Let's move on this, and we can send it across. Yes.
And I'm not just to get it on you, but I think let the staff put together. Right. But I think we have to kind of set a deadline and say that by the 15th, if we don't have some indication of what's going to move, if Alphonse Gaston's routine ought to come to an end here pretty soon.
Right.
These things become trading stock, and I don't think they should.
I mean, Mills, I could follow the discussion between Mr. Wyman and someone else. You sound me like the House bill is different. Unless it's more the same than it sounded like, it seems to me like maybe we ought to go ahead with this bill here. This sounds like a pretty innocuous bill that we've got in front of us today, 302. Sounds like this notification is I was doing my earlier thinking if the committee wants to make a motion, I'll accept the motion. I'd move the bill out with 2 and 90 put in.
Move that on line 6 in the blank, in the bill 2 be placed, and on line 10, 90 days be placed. All in favor of amendment, please.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I haven't been here at all the meetings, so I'm not aware of all these adjustments and changes, but is it 2 days realistic?
We have so.
I mean, surely, yeah. To respond as soon as possible, but I question whether we can actually do that within a 2 day period.
Anybody here from the Workman's Compensation Board?
Mm-hmm. Right in the back.
Yeah. What was the rationale for the 2 days?
That was the suggestion of
Bob Kennedy.
Yeah. Right.
AFL, Seattle.
Okay.
So, I'm Bob Kennedy, serving at the LCA, and it was at my suggestion of the 2 days. The reason for this is after having visited British Columbia, where they have a very good system,
After the up there, the doctor has 3 days in which to notify the board that he has treated an injury. The board then makes a determination whether a service coordinator should or should not go see this injured worker. And if the determination that is of such a nature that they should have a service coordinator be involved, then the service coordinator is there within 2 days. And that's the reason for the 2 days. So it's really a total of about 5 days from the time that the person is injured until a service coordinator is there. But what we want is we want the service coordinator there at a very early date.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Bob, I'm not sure if I perhaps understand all this, but it would occur to me that THA would be saying it pretty clearly. One of the contentions of groups that have stood here before is that the guy's waiting on the doorstep for his blood vision drive. Within a 2 day period, he's responding in a, say it's a holiday or a weekend, a 3 day weekend, time restraint, but not be able to fulfill that within a 2 day period.
Well, what the, when you're talking about the blood drying, as I say, we're talking about 3 days from the time the injury happened, another 2 days on top of that. So it'd normally be about 5 days. But some of these persons are really concerned about, and they really don't know how the system works. As a matter of fact, quite a number of business representatives don't even know how it works. And so what happened, they just say, well, contact an attorney. Well, we feel that an attorney should be involved in it at some time, but not right at the beginning. For instance, after C&E, if the person then feels that they haven't been treated fairly, then they should engage an attorney, but I don't see why they should have one before that time. And so this is the reason for the service coordinator being there early. And I can appreciate your concern about the holidays, and I think that a consideration could be given toward that, because that would be unreasonable to expect somebody to be out there on holiday.
Well, I'm just concerned that we don't write something in here that replacing the time restraint that is perhaps unlikely to be fulfilled at one time or another.
Yeah, well, the thing about this, the only reason that I made the suggestion that in British Columbia it does work. And that was the reason for bringing that suggestion.
Would you object to perhaps within 5 working days? Or just 5 days? Or 5 days, so it kind of gives a little bit more flexibility.
And of course, could we also say, shall send to, or if the letter means put in the mail, but U.S. Postal Service. Who can have workman's comp underwriting those fellows?
Well, this is, see, I'm a very strong supporter of service coordinators, and I think that not everybody might fully understand the brochure that does come to the injured worker at the end of 14 days or by 14 days. There's an individual here that's sitting in the front row that has had an experience. Maybe she might relate to you how long the delays have been, and so if you understand what has happened in the past.
I don't think anybody disagrees with where you're going. I think we're just trying to find some reasonable period of time. I think we all agree with your philosophy.
Well, why don't the 5 workdays, what's the matter with that?
I suppose there are any sanctions.
I mean, 2 workdays, and then because holidays are not workdays.
Bob, you hit upon one thing, and that it appears that you're talking here about something more than dropping a brochure in the mail.
Of course, that is correct.
Anytime anyone writes a law about notification, you run into the problems of what it means. Does that mean if they have to drop a brochure in and get it postmarked within 2 days, or does that mean that a service coordinator has to go out and make the a phone contact or a personal contact. I think if you really want, if you're thinking in terms of actual contact between the service coordinator and the injured workman, we might consider language to the effect the board shall cause a service coordinator to notify. I would think that the easiest way to comply with this, if we did pass it, would be to drop a brochure in the mail.
And well, as I stated earlier, that not every situation, I don't think, would call for the services of a service coordinator. They would just see once the report comes from the doctor, and let's face it, we have a toll-free line now to the board, so there isn't any additional cost to the medical profession to notify. All they have to do is make a call and tell what has happened. And then the board go from there, and if they think it's a serious type nature, why then, if it would call for the service of a coordinator, well then that would happen. But otherwise, why?
You would be happy just with the mailing of a brochure within a couple of days. You think that would be an improvement over what we have now?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not the minor injuries, I'm not concerned about those. I'm concerned about the serious type nature injuries that they do need the services of a service coordinator.
So surgery would be picked up under subsection 2 within 90 days or whatever.
No, that's too long.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the problem.
I just use my, within the section 2, the intent there is to actually get the service coordinator on the scene.
What is happening now is they're too late from getting there, and I've heard a lot of people talking about the litigation that has been happening, and quite frankly, that's part of the reason it happened, is because the service coordinator has not been there, and the persons do not understand their rights, and so they are just advised by, as I said before, some business representatives who don't understand the system. And so an attorney is involved in the situation from the word go. And as I said, I'm not opposed to attorneys becoming involved at the stage where I feel that they should be. But it has to be an early nature.
A 90-day limitation is certainly no requirement that the board has to wait that long. It would seem to me that the Workman's Compensation Board, if they get on the ball, could do it a lot sooner than that.
I thought that was, personally, I think that's wrong also at that stage of the game. But see, what that also addresses itself to is a determination as to whether or not for rehabilitation, I believe, this type of thing, or referring the person to other types of services. When really there's times when maybe all this person would need is physical therapy and not rehabilitation. And so 90 days is stretching out quite lengthy. I think it could be a lesser date than 90.
Mm-hmm.
Bob, my concern is, say, this refers to disabling compensatory injury. And if a person's disabled, he's going to be longer disabled than 2 days or 5 days. So it's not going to be an immediate thing that has to be right there. And that's my concern, that you just don't make it too short a period of time. I agree that what you're after, that you need to get the services to the person. My question, my concern is, I can't accept too short of a period of time, because I think we're going to wind up having to hire more people to go out there, so you can be there at a 2-day interval to be at these different places. And I can just see some other areas that might be affected with it.
So I think that the employers feel that the service coordinators are a good investment.
Now that we've spent so much time on this, I'm beginning to question the value of this bill at all. Having worked around and in complex organizations,
organizations, both private and public, I wonder how much good it's going to do to have a law that says somebody's got to do something within 2 days. And there's no penalty here. There's no way that the injured workman or the employer can enforce this. It's going to come down to somebody having a program and a philosophy and a direction in their organization to get this job done. And I would defer to more experienced people, senators or other people that told me I was wrong, but I just wonder what will happen to this. It seems to me that we're going to make a statement, you've got to do this, you've got to do that, and it's really going to be determined by how much money they have for service coordinators and what policies and what kind of program is really pursued to get the job done, rather than us saying 2 days or 5 days and this kind of thing. So I would be withdrawing my motion.
I think the response to that is the fact that the whole point of workman's compensation is to get the person rehabilitated as soon as possible, back in a functioning capacity as soon as possible, to get them back to work. That's the whole point and purpose of workman's compensation. Bob Kennedy's remark is well taken in the fact that he wants that person out there, the service coordinator, telling that person what benefits and what rights he has and as soon as possible. That's fine. My concern is not the fact that I'm opposed to providing those services. My concern is I'm concerned about putting too strict of a time limitation on this that cannot be responded within a reasonable time. So I think that's the difference.
If it meets with the approval committee, I'm going to appoint Jack Kalinowski, Bob Kennedy, and the gentleman representing the Workman's Compensation Board to get together.
George Moore.
And come up with a recommendation to fill at least two blanks on this bill, and the next time we meet, we can decide. I think we've got, I was in hope that this had already been done, but evidently there's too much disagreement in the time frame. Does that meet with the previous committee?
Yeah.
Okay. And is that all right? Well, by all that, that's just what I said is going to happen.
Where is your name?
303.
Mr. Chairman, this bill has been heard by the committee before on February 9th. The bill would change the situation that presently exists under workman's compensation that prohibits release of by workmen of any rights that are granted under the workman's compensation laws. It would provide for release for lump sum by workers of all rights. As long as such release is approved by the board, the Workman's Compensation Board, and there is a retained prohibition against releasing any medical or rehabilitation benefits. So what we're basically talking about, I guess, is permanent partial awards, permanent total awards.
A lump sum award.
Yeah, compromising release of those rights for a lump sum award.
With the purpose that the injured workman could go into business of his own or something like that if he so desired. Or go to Reno and blow it all.
We've had testimony on this. What's the pleasure of the committee?
Do you recall any testimony about how many releases we're talking about? I don't recall.
I remember the testimony on the bill. I don't think the number entered into the testimony from the person. Is anyone here that could give information along that line? Would you be interested in receiving testimony in that line?
Not particularly. I'm not terribly impressed by the bill to begin with, and I was just trying to assess the depth of need for some protection. And if you're interfering with the ability of a person to make a judgment for himself, and saying that he has to get some government to approve what he's doing, and if there's some substantial need, then perhaps, but I recall the purpose for which the story is introduced, but I guess it's supposed to open it up, isn't it?
Of course, under the private law, it would be impossible for him to enter into any kind of release and compromise agreement. This would allow,
a
modified system of release, as long as it was approved by the board. And
that was the objection, that aggravation would be eliminated then, isn't it?
So I think that the real question is, if a workman gets into the original world and then goes in on that injury and compromises and releases that award for a lump sum and then has a later aggravation of that original injury, I think there's a gray area, a question of what effect that compromising release is going to have on the later fines for aggravation, and whether it would be possible to receive benefits later for an aggravation of an injury that had already been compromised and removed.
Shouldn't we answer that question? As long as you raise it, say yes or no. How do you think? I think it depends on the person.
I don't know the answer to it. I
thought we could answer
it. Yeah, it needs someone who has worked in this area. I think it's going to be, I think maybe it will be a matter that will be settled by the court. I don't know if that there can be an absolute answer until it gets to the court, but I think it will be a
question.
We can put in
all these further claims, including aggravation.
But you can go either way on that.
Yeah.
In the statute by amendment.
Okay. Is there any discussion on the, by the board, what criteria they would use to,
I don't believe there's too much discussion of this particular problem, as I recall it. Something, a certain amount of uncertainty on the attributes of this measure, and I think I just pass it over because I don't think we have the votes here to get it out if it seems a motion. And operating on such a narrow margin, I don't see why we should go any longer. So,
do you want to table it or just?
No, I don't want to table it. Okay. But let's just set it over and go to the next bill. If you remember, this is the bill that would change the name of the compensation board to the workers' compensation. But men compensation board, the workers' compensation board, and after this bill passed out and they signed the Senator to Robert Stowe, I raised the question of what would happen to all the stationery and supplies and so forth that we might have on hand. So all we're doing here is, I guess you'd have to rescind the action that you took and then ask for amendments and put an effective date of January 1, 1978 in it.
What rescind is that on?
The action that this committee took from yesterday.
It was given a detail action in the time to Mary Roberts. However, it was decided after that that we should consult the agency affected to find out when would be an appropriate time.
Mm-hmm.
And on the basis of that is where we arrived at the January 1, 1978 date. So we want to put that into the bill.
What I'm trying to determine is, did the bill, was the bill referred back from on the floor?
No, it never went.
I knew we passed the bill to the floor.
Let me ask about, while we're in a subcommittee,
I know what you're trying to do is taking effect on January 1, 1978, but do you think there's any need to allow them a phrase in here? It just seems to me that we're not hung up about stationary and all that kind of stuff,
are we? No, as a matter of fact, when they were contacted, they originally suggested July 1, but then they were wondering if there could be something in the language to allow for, you know, things of that type. But then we concluded that it was probably easier all the way around and we would agree about the general language.
Well, the only problem, Chairman, is that we're desperately hopeful that the revised RAF will be published and out in the public hands in December of 77. You have a problem of whether we do it with this bill to suggest you delay it. And then say, then 2 more years are going to go by, do you anticipate it and put in workers' compensation? It's not that big a problem. I was trying to find it would be to make it effective, like October 1 or some such thing like that, but then give them a little leeway to into it.
That's agreeable.
I don't know.
Recognition
if it's necessary of a phase-in so that on and after October 1 they can start changing all the signs and stationery and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Well, how do you keep the same one?
Yeah.
You have a genius, people are coming down, but they're not coming.
So the cause really is in the language to suggest. I could see a long, notwithstanding time, notwithstanding that dream. In the view of the title of the board itself, very bad at stations.
What are we talking about in the studies in the ORF, the rules, would you like to do those when you reprint them, I think, rather than, wouldn't that be advisable to do it when you reprint them, rather than trying to try to hold a new set of rules just to make that correction?
Drop a phrase in as soon as possible under the board's discretion.
Yeah.
This kind of thing. You might give them 10 of
the question would be, is there any advantage to the emergency clause and going to July 1 to cut into their budget?
Yeah, the board is the only real thing we're concerned with.
Right.
To get this before us, I said it was the news that the committee reconsidered the action they took in sending 304 out of committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried. Now we have 304 before us again. Senator Carson, you wish to make a move? Motion?
Well, what if we put the emergency clause and made it effective on July 1 and then, as Richard indicates, given a studies and opportunity, given the discretion to pay the
top board.
Yeah.
You go up that line.
Yeah, it would just be something to assess that the way we found the issue was self-implied inspection within their discretion
as soon as
possible.
Yeah.
Okay. Everybody comfortable with the motion?
If the board stands on that, accepting the first before and then having the board send it in as soon as quickly as soon as possible thereafter. As forms come up from the same time, you need to reprint the rules and stuff like that.
You've heard the motion, please call the roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Hannon?
Aye.
Senator Joseph?
Aye.
Senator Wyatt?
Aye.
Senate Bill 62. Senator Roberts will carry this bill. He was assigned to it originally.
Oh, boy.
intended to be here this year.
This bill was heard on January 26th, at which time some amendments were offered, and we have two sets of amendments. One is a result of recommendation by Austin Crow of the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association. The longer one, much longer one, is prepared by legislative counsel, as was the first one, with the after meeting with the insurance commissioner and Tom Burson out of the mutual insurance. And they are not mutually exclusive, although we would have to be dovetailed together at the very end by legislative council. It seems to be no objection. Basically, they arrived at following the initial hearing, and all parties seem to be in concurrence as to adopting them.
Is there anyone here that wants to explain the
amendment? Mr. Howard, would you care to take the time?
I'd be happy to try to give a quick explanation of these amendments. This bill, Senator, as it was introduced, makes certain changes in the way the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association operates. The Guarantee Association is the body of all property and casualty insurers in Oregon that is formed for the purpose of picking up the tab when one of the companies becomes insolvent. The way the law presently works, the first $100 of each claim is excluded, and unearned premium, that is the unexpired portion of the premium, is not covered by the Guarantee Association. Under the law, the insurance commissioner holds certain deposits from these companies that become insolvent. And there is no provision in the law now that explains just what happens to these deposits when the Guarantee Association steps in and pays the claims. The deposit laws were all adopted long before there was such a thing as a Guarantee Association. And so in the bill as originally presented, the arrangement is made that the deposit will now cover unearned premiums. The Guarantee Association will cover unearned premiums. The first $100 deduction is eliminated, and the intention is that under the existing law, the Guarantee Association actually stands in the place of the claimant after the Guarantee Association pays off the claim, so that the Guarantee Association then has a right to those deposits. What these amendments do is provide a plan under which the deposits can be made immediately available to the Guarantee Association. So that instead of going out and assessing another $50,000 or $100,000, which they eventually will get back from the deposit, this just shortcuts that procedure and allows the receiver, which would be the commissioner, to ask the court for approval of a plan for the deposit to be made immediately available to the Guarantee Association. Again, the plan presented by the receiver to the court would call for the Guarantee Association to return any part of the deposit that was not needed by the Guarantee Association or that was needed for any other claims that the deposit might have been held for. Basically, the main claimant against the deposit is the Guarantee Association in its rights that it is obtained by paying off all the loss claims and the unearned premium claims. So this is kind of it's a very logical step just to give the association the deposit since they're going to pay out the money anyway. That's covered in this amendment. what would be the new sections 1 and 2 and 3. Now, one of the features that is being added, none of the present law, the Gandhi Association, has the individual insurers in the Gandhi Association specifically allowed to increase their rate filings in the future to make up for the assessments that they have been subjected to by the Gandhi Association law. This amendment would adopt the same privilege for them as the Life Guarantee Association has of offsetting against their premium taxes over a 5-year period the amount that they are assessed to pay these loss claims of insolvent insurers. And then the bill would logically then do away with this premium increase provision. That's the repeal of 34,680. In its place, it would substitute a premium tax write-off over a 5-year period of the amount of the assessment. Section 4 of this amendment is very long, and all it does is make a housekeeping change in the public records law. On page 8 of the amendment, the two underscored sections, 734,650 and 734,830, Attorney General's office called our attention to the fact that in those two sections there is the provision that those records are confidential, but there is no similar cross-reference in the public records law, which there should have been. I think it was the one law, 830, was passed later than the public records law, and the other one was earlier and was just inadvertently omitted. But this is a more of a housekeeping matter and takes up a number of pages of this amendment. And finally, that's all that those amendments do, this large packet. The other amendment that was submitted by Mr. Crow is intended to take care of a problem which is a rather difficult one to get at. It arises when an accident occurs and a person has a claim against his insurer. An injured party has a claim against a tortfeasor who is insured by an insolvent insurer. And the injured party under the law, because the other party's insurer is insolvent, the injured party collects from his own insurance company, for example, under an uninsured motorist clause. The law now says that the Gandhi Association can't go back against in that case, the Gandhi Association has no liability. The law does say that the Gandhi Association cannot exercise subrogation rights against insolvent insurers or against any other insurer, but there is no protection in the law now for the person whose insurance company became insolvent. The uninsured motorist carrier can, under the present law, go against that tortfeasor personally, even though he was insured and he had protection under the Gandhi Association. Because of the way the thing works, he can still be sued individually by the company that paid the claim. And that's the purpose of this amendment, is to give him that personal protection against insurance companies or any guarantee associations up to the limits of the policy that he held in the insolvent insurer.
Is this avoiding double recovery? Is this the
way it is? Well, no, it's avoiding insurance companies trying to get that what they have paid out from the individual who caused the loss. And it's a loss they otherwise would not have been able to recover from the Guarantee Association, but they go against the person individually. He's just left naked because his insurer became insolvent. The whole purpose of the Guarantee Association is to prevent losses because of insolvent insurers. And if there had been no insolvent insurers, this matter would never have arisen. But because the man's insurer becomes insolvent, the companies go around in a circle and eventually try to get back at this person whose insurer became insolvent. And some companies do, some don't, but this would close that door.
Mm-hmm.
All
right. Well, I can't blame the company to do it for doing it. And I think it hates the doctor now. There's no thing out of on the fourth floor of the new room today. I've been watching the interest of empty space out there, and I'm very relieved to say that it's filled now with new furniture that could be set up soon. And I'm very glad to say the people soon after that. But I don't quite understand how the circle is closed yet. Yeah. I know you've explained it not far enough there, but not quite all of it.
I wish Mr. Crow were here to explain it because it's a little outside my field, but I can cite one specific kind of case. And perhaps if you and I are the participants here, it'll be simpler to understand. Suppose that I'm covered by an insurance company that becomes insolvent, and you and I have had an accident, and I injured you. Normally, you would sue me or collect from my insurance company, but my insurance company became insolvent. Then the law says that, or in your policy says that, in this event, you go against your own insurance company under your uninsured motorist clause. They pay you the amount that my insurance would otherwise have paid you. Now, your insurance company there's no prohibition now for your insurance company then to sue me individually for the amount that your insurance company paid you.
Well, why don't I sue you in the first place and then the Guarantee Company?
Of course, you can come in. Because there is a provision in the Guarantee Association law that says that you will look to other policy coverages that are available first before you go to the Guarantee Association.
This is another way that the insurance companies that remain solvent have agreed in advance that they will spread the risk rather than having it all fall on the Guarantee.
Yeah, the Guarantee Association is supposed to be the last resort.
Has been raised that if we don't have a threshold, if we remove the $100 deduction and don't replace it with $25 or $50 or some threshold, that the Guarantee Program will be besieged with demands for return of premium of small amounts. Do you have any feeling on that?
Well, there's no doubt about it that it will greatly increase the paperwork and the obligation of the Guarantee Association, because you are now dealing with every policyholder of the insolvent insurer instead of just every claimant against the insolvent insurer. And that's no denying that. The other side of the picture is that some unearned premium claims are substantial. If a man has a substandard automobile insurance policy, his premium may well be $1,000. Sometimes, in the history has been that these so-called personal loan of those carriers are the ones most likely to go broke, and you may have a man with one company that goes broke and his agent puts him in another company and it goes broke. That actually happens. So Dan was $2,000, and the fact that it's unearned premium doesn't make the pill any less bitter for the person who loses the $2,000. So it was originally felt that the people should just absorb this loss and the Guarantee Association be relieved of it. But
maybe I didn't state that right. Maybe I don't understand it. But I'm not talking about getting back in premium. I'm setting a nuisance or a threshold and saying if your premium, unearned premium at the time your company sold is less than $25 or $50, no claim will be made. That's what I'm trying to get at.
You're saying that you suppose, for example, you allow the unearned premium claims, but you have a $100 deductible from all claims. Now that there's logic to that process. The only problem, the big problem I see in that kind of is dealing with the special deposit law that we have, which doesn't have the $100 deduction, and I think you would almost have to put in that $100 deduction for the special deposit also. So the insurance commissioner would be faced with the problem of after the Guarantee Association has met its responsibilities, then these leftover $100 would all have to be met out of the deposit that the commissioner was holding. It would create a lot of complications. So the two would have to mess, but certainly you could logically put in the provision that unearned premium claims would be covered, but $100 would be deducted from all claims.
Do you have any recommendations one way or the
other? Well, no, I'm kind of in a neutral ground here. Everybody has his own feelings on the subject. The Agents Association is particularly anxious to have unearned premium claims covered. The agents have felt a responsibility to their policyholders and have been paying these unearned premiums in effect by obtaining new coverage for an insured and giving him credit for his unearned premiums. So if an agency has a number of these in one insurance company, even at $100 a crop loss, it can be fairly substantial.
And the agents
have
set up rather than the
agents have been doing that. They haven't got any obligation to do so, but they've.
And you think that's likely to continue? That if you suggest $100 or $50 threshold, that the insurer will get his money and it's just the agent that eats it? Probably.
I think that would be the case, yeah.
How about what are there any provisions for the remission of commissions?
Theoretically, an agent is supposed to pay back the unearned commission to the receiver of the insolvent insurer. And I think that there has been a great variation in practice among the states on whether this has actually been demanded of agents or not. We had an insolvency in Oregon in 1962, and the court considered that question and sort of compromised it. It did not require the agents to pay back the unearned commission.
And you don't have any recommendations to that?
No. No.
Is there any interest in the subcommittee on the deductible on the double matter?
Let
us say it's true. That'd be in the amendment.
That language is in the original bill on page 5, line 3.
Mr. Chairman.
Can I rise?
Line 3, where it reads now. Except for the credit card. My understanding, being a temporary chairman, isn't exactly the greatest sometimes as far as knowing what's going on is concerned. But my understanding is these amendments were worked out by the committee. They had the approval of the chairman of the committee, Tom Bessonet, Frank, and legislative council worked on the amendments. What's your pleasure regarding them? Yes, Mr.
Chairman. I don't think there is, I haven't seen the amendments that have been drafted, but this moment I might exhaust some time. Is it supposed to be done so?
No, okay.
No. I'm okay.
I'm glad to hear that. Well, we had one amendment that we were not in favor of, and I just wanted to make sure it wasn't included in there.
Okay.
I might just point out a typographical error, Mr. Chairman, on the first page of the amendment, the large amendment in section 2, the fifth line, the word D-I-S-T-E-R-S-E should be D-I-S-B-U-R-S-E.
What was that now?
Amendment? On the amendment, section 2, line 5.
Whatever.
Either one or the other.
Dispersed
and
D-U-R-S-E.
Okay, last time.
committed to just about the local public contact with users. I think that's the kind of thing that I have to
do. And the vision
is that the bill is here that
they can be able to do
it. Yeah, it's really good now, but if you can lead it to the fit, if it's local contact with users, it's here to do it.
That is a complete redundancy with another section of the statute.
it relates to the retainers by a contractor from a subcontractor on a public improvement project. That same issue is covered by Chapter 701 Oregon Revised Statute. It's just an attempt to do nothing more than clean up a redundancy. In Section 1 of the bill, subsection 1, the people that we discussed this with suggested that instead of having a flat-out provision in the statutes requiring monthly progress payments on work as it progresses, that we insert unless the terms of the contract provide otherwise. The intention there is to say that it is entirely possible that some public bodies may want to prescribe at the time a project is being bid that the contractor will be paid in a different manner. We have no objection to that. The substitution of the word progress for partial, as it is in, I believe you have it in line 6 and also in line 11 and several other places, is simply to use a word that is consistent in the industry, has no real significance. In line 21 on page 2 of the bill, the phrase "and the agency with approval of the contractor's surety shall eliminate retainers on monthly contract payments after 50% of the work under the contract is completed if such work is progressing satisfactorily." This is language that is intended to replace a limit of any kind on the a dollar limit, if you will, on the amount of retainers that could be withheld. This is intended to say that if the public agency is satisfied that work is progressing properly and the surety, the insurance company that's providing the bond, is satisfied that their insured is working properly, then the retainers may be reduced. In effect, what that would do, Mr. Chairman, is allow the possibility that at the end of the contract, no more than 2.5% of the dollar volume of work can be held. On page 3, at the request of those who exhibit some concerns, in line 3 and also in line 13, and I should also add related in line 7, we're suggesting that instead of talking about completion of the work under the contract, we're talking about completion of all contractual obligations. And we think this is reasonable since in a construction contract there are some other obligations. Filing of wage certifications is an example. It is a contractual obligation that is not directly related to the work under the contract. This would give the public agencies more control. Line 14, there was some concern about the 15 days that we agreed to restore the existing wording for 30 days. Talking about the time period in which interest will begin to run on a late payment. The amendment simply restores the wording that is in the existing statute. The same thing is true in the amendments on line 3 and line 16 to 20. In essence, restoring the existing wording, instead of interest at the rate of 1% per month, it's 6% per annum, which is in the existing law. In line 21, the amendments there are to, what's happening here on line 9, page 3? The shall may business. Oh, excuse me. Senator, I'm glad you brought that to my attention. We discussed that in our direct testimony on the bill. I did want to stress, however, if I had the opportunity, the purpose of this. The existing law says that the contractor shall notify the public contracting agency when he considers the work completed, and then within 15 days, the public body is to respond. The intention of changing the word shall to may is to say that he may do so, and if he does, then the second part of the last half of that phrase, which requires response by the public agency, will be triggered. If he does not, then that response from the public agency is not triggered, nor is it mandatory upon them. Some public bodies, Senator, have interpreted this entire sentence with the use of the word shall to say that they cannot, in fact, terminate a contract until they get a letter from the contractor. That they cannot determine that the work is completed. So this allows them to say, without any notification from the contractor, we consider it to be complete. And by changing shall to may, that response by them is not automatically triggered.
Well, we're testing on that day that in that hearing that the mayor could put it in a situation where the Alphonse Gaston, as was referred to earlier this morning, where the public agency contractor is pretty much finished what he's planning on doing, but he doesn't have the obligation to say so, and so the public contractor coming out kind of inspecting the work has to ask, are you finished with this, are you finished with that? And it just shifts the burden, as I remember. I don't remember that burden shift kind of thing, Senator, but certainly that isn't the intent. I don't believe the sentence read in its entire context would lead one to that conclusion. The contractor simply cannot unilaterally terminate a contract. Documents, nearly all of them, very clearly take care of that. Should I continue, Senator Wise? I don't want to leave that subject if you still have questions in your mind. I was expecting to see something in the amendments about that. I've got a note here that I wrote during the testimony, and I had the impression some of the public, at least one of the public agency witnesses, public contracting agency witnesses, had raised the concern there. Well,
if you've got me on what the contract says, because I haven't inspected any of them, but I don't know what question I can ask you to help make it clear right now.
Let's take your time
to let it go on the other way around.
And then maybe I could say for 10 of the wives benefit and those that we discussed, you know, the overall amendments to the bill with, I don't believe at any rate that there is any remaining concern about that. I suppose the next thing to address, Mr. Chairman, is page 4. In line 4, you'll see the addition of the words and in a manner authorized by the Public Contract Review Board. This is inserted to ensure that anything that is done by with the contract is retained by any public body would be handled in a manner that is authorized by administrative rule by the Public Contract Review Board. They have rules now that are applicable, and this wording would simply ensure that whatever is done in that manner. In line 10, you'll see the addition of the words, interest on such bonds or security shall accrue to the contractor. In my original testimony on this bill, I pointed out to counsel for the Gresham School Board, question whether that was proper in a contract that they were letting for school building, and this wording is inserted to clarify any possible misunderstanding. In subsection 3, beginning on line 11 on page 4, there was some concern exhibited by some people that any retainage that is deposited by the public body in a bank account to be held in a secure fashion for the public agency and any interest would be subject to withdrawal by the contractor. We worked out the wording to say that in lines 13 and 14 the interest is not subject to withdrawal by the contractor, but simply accrues to him. The next thing after line 14 is an amendment requested by the subcontractors, and again in my original testimony, although we did not know the existence of that amendment, pointed out to the committee that I knew such an amendment was going to be considered, and if it had the same requirements upon the subcontractor that the general contractor has with a public agency, we would have no objection. The amendment in line 29 is to coincide with the original amendment that I discussed here today to make sure that the cities and counties and CUD's authority to opt out of the Public Contract Review Board is not included in the bill. There is one other amendment that is being proposed. It has to do with bid depositories, Mr. Chairman. The amendment says that the
to avoid collusion and to increase competition between subcontractors bidding on public contracts, use secure bid depositories or bid registries where available is encouraged. There are some depositories or bid registries in the state of Oregon. I have a list of them for you. Where they are in use in Portland, Salem, Eugene, and Medford. They do have a great tendency to reduce what's called bid shopping by a general contractor or the subcontractor's bid. I think it's entirely appropriate to encourage their use. It's not mandatory.
What should that be in the law?
Well, Mr. Chairman, to bring it to the attention of the agencies, it's possible that public agencies are simply not aware of them, and if they are aware of them, they might want to require in the contract that they be used.
Did you include them in the amount or two before? I mean, I don't get the point.
Well, the manager of the electrical bid depository in Portland here. Could I bring him up, Mr. Chairman? Would you like to hear from him?
Well, I guess so. But Senator Carlson, is this a point or not? You're a lawyer.
Sometimes it's sort of preparatory language. It has no sanction. It's akin to me to a preamble or a policy statement. And while I agree with you, good yeah. idea, you either ought to say you ought to do it or ought not to do it. I don't
know. Right.
My view on that. I agree
well,
with you.
We'd like to see the use of these being encouraged rather than be made mandatory. Call it two-step legislation, if you will, but if it's brought to the attention of the public bodies and used and is found to be acceptable as general public policy, then in future sections of legislature, you might want to make them mandatory.
I think my concern with Senator Returns is our function here to write laws for the conduct of various of our society, or is it to make recommendations on how to conduct bidding and so on. I might have a whole series of suggestions on how to conduct bidding, but I don't think it's appropriate. If you direct an agency to do it, or direct the state to do it, or some such thing, I'm not figuring maybe where you want to go. I think it's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I share the chairman's concern that perhaps putting a kind of structural language and statute to encourage it is well beyond the we ought to be writing it all.
Well, Senator Roe pointed out to me this morning, this is kind of like saying it is the intent of the legislature that public improvements will be constructed at least possible cost.
Yeah, precisely.
It says,
it's the intent of the legislature to save costs. Now, how have we saved a million great body of law forward, or how can any citizen save one dime by the cost of the bill, but to save 5 grand statement?
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, motherhood, apple pie.
I think the difference in this, Senator Carlson, is that at least this brings the existence of these depositories where they are available in these four areas of the state.
So what
the attention of those people.
Would it not be better then, I'm not suggesting this is what we ought to do, to direct some agency to bring it to the attention of the state? I'm not sure that contractors sit down of an evening and thumb through the ORFs to find helpful hints on how to contract. Apparently, your view of the matter is a little different than ours. I think that you ought to tell a state agency you're going to do this, or you tell all Oregonians to do it, or we get out of it. This is not a state of credit.
Well, I can imagine contractors going through long evening. Chatting with Jack Kalinowski about helpful things.
Right on. Well, I can see
you.
Right, I can see AGC meetings, and I can see AOC meetings, and OOC meetings, and a variety of other things for people to step to, which I think is it.
More than half of it,
then the public body could, with options, excuse the attorneys altogether. And we support that. We feel that the public body should have that power. If the contract is more than 50% complete, then it could forgive the attorneys. But until it is, the full amount should be obtained. Now, the hazard of this, for under our present law, is the public body has the authority to require either a bond, a cashier's check, or some other form of deposit. I imagine that the well-advised public bodies disdain any other type of performance security than the bond and require it. The premium for the bond is based upon the 5% return. The should notice is that a little apprehensive, maybe more than just a little apprehensive, and that return is called below 5%. And all of this diminishes, it's supposed to build you up, boost you up, and change the situation to reduce the impact from a reduction from 5% to the real deal. If the return is reduced, then my advice to my client is that this will have an adverse effect upon the premium for this type of bond, and that the net result will be to perhaps reduce the number of contractors who otherwise would be able to participate in this bidding on this type of work, because they wouldn't be able to secure a bond. Now that's just the, it's not a big issue, Mr. Chairman, but it's a point that I would like to have made originally, and I'm sorry I couldn't have made it. there's no way to work that this bill can be amended to satisfy my client in that regard. And I thank you for your permission to let me appear on it.
Glad you had the opportunity. You're somebody else. Were there any questions with Mr. Bennett?
I just have a second. Why is the availability of bonding based upon retainers? Apparently, the public contract is really looking for is a bond and not the retainers. Why are the sureties so interested in the 5% retainers? It's the back of the premium.
Remember now, in public contracts, corporate citizenship in the community, so almost the beginning of the 20th century. At that time, in the fixed place of personal citizenship, at that time, the premium and the trust, the authority of citizenship, was based upon the fact of the payment, which has been in existence for many years prior to the coming of the 20th century. So it's been a fact of life in citizenship, ever since we started corporate citizenship. And they just reviewed the whole system of it based upon the security. At one time, at the beginning, maybe in the 1900s, the retainer was around 15%. Then it got down to 20%. And I think in some government contracts, it's 20%. And the 50% rule that I just mentioned obtains protection of a 10% retainer, which can be altogether eliminated. If the 50% of the work is being satisfactory, so it has an adverse effect. Who is measured on this? And one of these funds that could come in the hands of the surety, the way of a big operation, would be the return. And no way below
5%. Okay, thank you.
Okay, if the amendment says that the bond could be reduced only with the consent of the surety, that would remove your major objection, would it?
If the bond could be reduced?
Yeah, if the retainers could be reduced only with the consent of the surety.
Yeah, if the retainers less than 5% would be reduced only with the consent of the surety. And yeah. I imagine that would have to be, this has to be an original contract document, don't it? I don't know that it needs to be, but I could be done.
Well, if the contractor were willing to do it, and the agency were willing to do it, and the surety were willing to do it, it could be done.
I think if all parties agreed to do it, and they're able to do it,
Okay, and the question then would be whether or not the public body is required to do it. That's the typical question.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So, we're good. You say you're applying with the national insurance.
It's a trade association composed of about 150 companies that write casualty, surety, fire, and workers' compensation insurance. And most of they're the capital stock companies that host the mutuals and so
forth. Well, they even said to you that in the North, circumstances. Your 5% or reduction below 5% be acceptable. So what I'm going to do, without being on the book, we're going to do is to have it on the bill that it can be reduced below 5% if security will consent, if your belief is that they're never going to consent.
Well, I don't know. I believe that they will never consent to a reduction below 5%.
Well, what percentage of all the surety companies,
I don't know that, Senator. My guess, the last time I checked that was over 5 years ago, and I think that the ratio is still about the same. We probably represent close to 30% of the total premium written. Maybe higher than that in the construction industry. Of the total premium written for construction contracts, both public and private.
So don't you think then that with the retainers being nearly the depth of this bill, that if we went ahead and passed it, knowing that it wouldn't be insured, it's categorically unacceptable to the people who are doing the surety work, that we would be moving documents.
Yeah.
I'll ask you what that means later.
The theory industry, doesn't want to come in here and say that it opposes the legislation. What it does want to say is that, from the standpoint of the shooting industry, this is not wise legislation. It doesn't like it. It's going to have an adverse effect on the issues of contracts involved.
Well, I'm beginning to know now that I've said what I thought it was about 30 minutes ago, which was this term, I never thought we'd see this again after the chairman appointed the subcommittee. Well, that chairman isn't here. Any other questions for Mr. Bennett? You state your name then for the case of Bennett, Chairman, and Jack Henry also for the Department of Higher Education. Karen Anstey identified me as one of the persons who participated in the drafting of some of these amendments. I would like to mention that this does not imply the concurrence with all of the amendments, because there was one very substantial factor that I addressed in my original testimony in the hearing on the bill that has not been satisfied in any of the proposed amendments, and concerns particularly on page 4 of the bill, where subsections 3 and 4 of section 4 of the bill, which provides for the first time an option to a contractor to elect to have whatever retainage is held by a public body deposited into a bank, savings bank, trust company, or savings association. I indicated to you before that this would involve then a two-check payment for every project payment that would be made. I also indicated that, I believe I did, and certainly intended to, that in the event that the contractor were to take advantage of the opportunity in subsection 4 to convert the amount held in a savings account for his benefit into securities, the bill does not address the question of who would be responsible for actually selecting those securities and actually purchasing those securities. Nor does the bill in its present form or with the proposed amendment respond to the question about whether a contractor can or could make a separate decision with respect to each project payment, saying in effect that he could have some securities on deposit with the public agency. He could indicate on the next project payment that he wanted the retainers withheld, and on the following payment he could have it deposited in a savings account, and he could ask that the account be switched from one to another, and the bill does not provide that. I'm sure the intent is to allow only one option, but the bill does not clarify the response of whether such an option would be available for each project payment or simply for a particular job. I have a firm conviction that it is not the responsibility of the public body to deposit the money for a contractor in any particular account, nor to allow him to switch from one basis to another during the progress of the job. And I would seriously request that subsections 3 and 4 of section 4 of the bill be deleted, leaving the two opportunities available for the contractor, one that the public body would withhold the amount as traditionally has been provided in the statute, and the other, which is also currently available, that he can substitute securities which are approved by the Public Contract Review Board in lieu of having any retainers. But I just do not believe that a public body should be in the position of having to split the project payment and to maintain the savings arrangement that's contemplated by subsection 3 of section 4 of the bill. I discussed this with others representing public bodies, and they concur in this same argument that a public body should not be in the banking business for the contractor, that this should be the responsibility of the contractor himself in determining whether he has the retainers held by the public body or uses securities in lieu of the retainers. And if the option is to be provided for the savings, then I think the language needs to be modified to set forth the terms and conditions under which the securities may be purchased, or bank accounts may be opened and closed, or transferred between one bank and another.
Any questions? Well, I have been taking action on this bill this morning. It's obvious there's quite a few concerns yet, and I'm certainly just as he can take it. That's what he gets for being chairman. Chairman 57.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not. I want to thank the committee for their patience to
Chairman, I have a question that Mr. Allen might be able to very simply and effectively simplify this set of actions back here with us, and what changes have been made by your subcommittee, and what you are removing.
All right, thank you, Allen.
Thank you.
My name is John Allen, I'm the superintendent of the bank. Mm-hmm. I ask that this bill be brought back to the committee to review. Errors in it that were rather important. You have my testimony, and I will paraphrase it. The two principal amendments. One is, if we raise our fees beyond that which the bill permits,
a suit to make the deal, we have to do it through two bodies. One for legislature and one for the board. The unfortunate language says there's a need committee. So that has been removed from the legislative assembly language is substituted. I thought that would, county votes and things like that. But then the other thing is in section 1239, 5257, relating to the fraudulent or dishonest practices of injunctive orders. And in the first section, this talk here, this is the banking section, it says the superintendent may, and then in these other sections, it says the superintendent shall. So if we had somebody that had a traffic ticket or was busted at 16 for smoking pot or something, well, we would have to remove them from office, we'd have to pull the charter and so on, and that isn't at all the intention. So we substituted the word may instead of shall, and that corrects that. And then in the area where we talk about the felony, the demands looked at this, and I couldn't get any consensus of really what it did mean, but the intention is that if someone has been convicted of either a felony or a misdemeanor, it must show an element of fraud with it, or we can't look to it.
Page 27
is the typical.
I would refer the committee to make sure you're looking at A and Gross some of that. I think some of the names are correct.
Mr. Chairman, to that point, Senator Ford brought up the concern and said he suggested amendments would make it clear that whether felony or misdemeanor and others serve to be a ground for the superintendent to take action, would have to have an extent on him to fraud. And that's what the superintendent intended, and we changed the language by adding the words
either so that shows up in all the sets. He has been convicted of a felony or of a misdemeanor, either of which an essential element is fraud. This is fraud.
And that's kind of in keeping with the spirit of Senator Ford's request.
I raised a question about this in the floor. And I didn't like doing it there, but so I want to do it here. Maybe I can do it clearer here. I don't think we always make things difficult for people who've done some little thing like put a plug nickel in a pot machine 20 years ago. But the parallel in my mind between the person you're looking for in the criminal system, the person who is going to commit a violent crime again, who you want somewhere or another, keep locked up. And the person who's got a character trait that's going to be dishonest. And I think sometimes in the past, we've had a tendency to somehow know these people who know how to dress nicely and so forth and talk nicely get past our attention. And I don't understand the niceties of the better way it is, but I was asking some of the question that day, and I'd like to renew the question now. Is there anything more we could do to guard against the banking financial industry into throwing these people out? Because they do exist. Thank you.
problem level. When we get past the problem level, though, we don't have the control over it that we would like to have. When directors or elected officers are employed, examiners come in, etc. And we have not had the vehicle to get to the police records. We were barred from it because of some language that crept into the RS in the last session or two or three years. And so we sought to get that exemption and did not prevail. And that's why we then adopted this language, which has been acceptable language to that committee that was making those exemptions. Now, the rehabilitation concept, of course, is one that came up with Mr. Corey. And he looked at that. Indeed, we had chartered a credit union staff by felons, ex-felons. And we looked into their background very carefully into how long have they been out, what are they now doing in the community, are they employed, are they being active in public affairs and so on. And when we got past those tests, we then were willing to take the chance. But when we get into area as broad as banking, where we indeed have a pyramid, a valley, billions of dollars in the state are held by a handful of people, in effect. We needed this protection to discover. Now we can go in and discover where we can, and have various ways we can do it, and it gives us an opportunity to remove them if we've got a pattern there that is bad. And so, you know, I think your point is that the integrity must be extremely high in this area, because we're trying to push things loosely, I hope.
But you feel, I just asked the Walt Brantley question, do you feel that this goes as far as we can go in our area? It gives you as much strength to do it. One of the things I know from legal profession is that it's a commendable human trait to forgive and to want to help your brothers, but sometimes it's the people you know best that you're most vulnerable to.
I have been victimized by robbery statements from my banking career, not which to speak. I don't know how we're going to legislate conclusively on something like that. A lot of source material is at the federal level, you know, on top of FBI or whatever, and we don't have access there directly, although in banks, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation does investigate at a level at which we can't, and we have that additional safeguard. But to be able to write legislation that conclusively blocks, I don't know how to do it. any more than we can legislate against, we have legislation against robbery and whatever, but we had to stop it. And you never know, it's just the first time of it is difficult to anticipate.
Okay.
Following up on some of your notes, have you had any moments that sometimes like the scoreboard where you have reviewed somebody who had a criminal record and he later was nailed for
indefinite
or something? I mean, and he didn't succeed, but he left the guy in that office, and out of the bank.
seen it, so.
Well, I have that power to believe in the definitely book.
When
I'm thinking about is this person who's having some personality problem, which may be due to some acute situations happened,
whatever,
health in the family, marriage, or something, or the person who just gradually
his personality is just
gradually moving toward losing control of the limitations on him. That he's having early run to trigger him off. Because we all tend to be reluctant to tear into somebody who's just maybe known to work with for years and has been doing a good job, and then we just see them gradually.
Well, we have that capacity now, because we do that through the examination process. We're working towards automating the early learning system, setting up, we have our criteria set up, and then we document it with figures and facts and so on, what's the person learn, how bad are the loans, and what is the projection. If you're going downhill, we review that directly with the senior officers of the bank and the board of the bank, and they're obviously, they do it too. And what you speak of, we see very frequently, and without exception, these people find themselves out of a job in the institution. They're removed, because there's no way they can deal with fiduciary funds. You're going to go at length to the detriment of the depositors and stockholders. So they're out. That one is the easiest one to identify. It shows up now.
Thank you for your patience, Mr. Chairman.
The balance one is also in the
other. Yeah, I know you
remember. You have to extend the action you had before.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
The day you set out.
Send your cards to me, the amendments for Medicaid Council dated 3277 the day before you. In opposition? Then, the question is 57 to the third, due process as amended. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Hannon?
Aye.
Senator Jason?
Aye.
Senator Wiley?
Aye. Thank you. Before we adjourn, I was presented with a bill to be entitled a committee bill. And this was carried with the chairman. It's from Mortgage Bankers and Savings Loan Association. It has to do with user rates, that's all I know. From the Mortgage Bankers and Savings and Loan Association.
I move we authorize the Senator for the committee bill.
Is there no opposition?
So ordered.
You take that up in the middle, not as many things.
What is the owner?
You didn't read it. I read it. It's a bad case for you. I thought it was. I didn't get it. So I asked the father if that was the case, and he said, no, it wasn't anything like that. So I don't know.
That doesn't mean that it is. I'm
trying
to say, no, but you know, it was after a week.
It's a matter of experience to someone. We should pass more bills.
Hard to pass bills. I don't have a sense of that. And I didn't really know where Johnny was coming from on those two later bills. And the other. I guess it's good that he wouldn't be back and do anything.
Yeah.
I'll be looking at it.